Hello, I'm Kirsty Young. Thank you for downloading this podcast of Desert Island Discs from BBC Radio 4. For rights reasons, the music choices are shorter than in the radio broadcast. For more information about the programme, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4. My castaway this week is the campaigner Dame Julia Cleverdon. As head of the charity Business in the Community, she fine-tuned to perfection the art of persuasion. A phone call from her and many of the big beasts of the business world, the pinstripes she calls them, stride from their boardrooms intent on giving something back to society. Her energies and endeavours have powered countless corporate social responsibility programmes. In a life dedicated to public service, she has charmed not only chief executives, but apparently royalty too. His Royal Highness the Prince of Wales is a long-time supporter and collaborator. She seems keenly aware that not everyone has her good fortune of a first-class education and top-drawer connections. When she's not harrying the Blue Chip Brigade, she's inspiring young people from all sorts of backgrounds to follow her example and get involved in social action. She says one of the most important leadership roles is to grow people. It's very much like gardening. You tend them and apply fertiliser, but sometimes you have to prune them to make them grow stronger. So welcome, Dame Julia Cleverdon. By reputation, you are one of those people who appears to employ sort of three parts cajoling, one part bullying to get people to do things. Is that a description you recognise, do you think?
I think persuasion is always about trying to inspire, encourage, enthuse people that things could be better, we could do it different. Occasionally there's a bit of quid pro quo, there's a bit of, if you could do this, A, this would make a difference to schools in tough times or kids in gone off the tracks, but it could also make a difference to the business that you're running, to the cause you're campaigning for, to the you're a junior minister, I'm sure you'd like a photograph of yourself in this particular situation. So I suppose, there's an element of encouragement and I would think bullying's a bit strong.
Charm. There's a lot of charm involved, I think.
Somebody did once call me a magenta steamroller. I am very, very clear about if we could do this, this would make the difference.
You came in today wearing a wonderful magenta coat. That is something I've watched you in documentaries and things. That's something of a signature, is it? You always tend to wear a nice bright colour.
Well, Business in the Communities, which I was privileged to be the chief exec for 17 marvellous years, our colours were magenta.
The areas of charity and social responsibility, those initiatives often suffer, I hope this rings a bell with you, of being populated by some people who are sort of, you know, they're there because they're, well, not to put too fine a point on it, sort of self-aggrandising do-gooders. What do you do about those people? Do you just bat them out the way?
You can tell pretty fast, actually, who's in it for aggrandisement and who's in it because they really want to use their considerable business skills to make a difference.
When you see people doing that, you know, they're for their own ends rather than to help the people they're supposed to be helping, are they struck off your list? Are they turfed out?
No, there's, you know, I'm a great believer in repentance. And there are examples, certainly in the history of Business and Community, of companies who we've fought and fought and fought to get into membership. And I always say that I read the Times death column on the basis that, you know, while there's death, there's hope. Occasionally some maddening character leaves or pops their clogs and then you can get in and change the influence of that company. So, no, I never give up on anybody.
Let's go to the list, Dame Julia. Eight, as we know, eight tracks. Tell us about your first one then. Why have you chosen this?
I was brought up in a marvellous, happy family with tremendous parents. My father was in the BBC, he was a radio producer, and he was absolutely thrilled when I was born after my poor mum had had seven or eight miscarriages, and I was finally born in 1950, live baby, and I was the absolute adored apple of the eye, I fear. And he took me when I was very young to the opera house to see great ballets and later to see Fontaine and Nureyev, and the piece I've begun to remind me of him and that incredible happy relationship we had is The Dance of the Knights from Romeo and Juliet.
Romeo The Dance of the Nights from Romeo and Juliet by Sergei Prokofiev, performed by the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. They are conducted by Sir George Shalty. So, Dame Julia Cleverdon, you once said that not everyone in business is driven by the mating call of the Porsche. But I wonder, how much of a danger do you think there is that corporate social responsibility might seem to a lot of people, well, to borrow a phrase from Prince Charles, a sort of lipstick on the gorilla. You know, that actually all these huge businesses are doing are making themselves seem nice. But behind the scenes, we all know what they're after.
Well, that's why the great thing in the last 20 years has been the transparency, which is now so clear. I mean, as you imagine, I've spent 40 years of my life in the business world. I believe in business. I believe in business creating the stuff, providing the goods and services, incomes and jobs, tax for the compassion, all the rest of it. But I absolutely believe that business now is in a glass bowl. You know, at any moment, any business across the world can be caught behaving badly in child labour in Indonesia or disgraceful behaviour down a supply chain. And that's good for business. It puts much greater pressures on them. But it does mean that all of us have got to work to ensure that we are responsible throughout our influence chain, our employment chain, our what we're doing in the communities. And, of course, there are laggards. There are also some great leaders. And part of the challenge now is trying to get the leaders to really communicate and drive what needs to be done and to clean up the laggards.
You appear to be an inveterate networker. Does the... Does the mask ever slip? Do you ever get really blinking exhausted and say, oh, not tonight, can't be bothered?
Well, no. My fingers itch every time I arrive in any gathering as to who's doing what. Could I learn more about what's working? How could X be made to do Y? That poor school hasn't got a decent governor. That teach firster needs more support. So, yeah, my daughters say I'm completely impossible, really. Can't have a conversation about anything other than how the world might be changed.
Second piece of music, Dame Julia Cleverdon. Tell me about this. What are we going to hear now?
Well, I had a very happy, marvellous childhood, house awash with books. My mum, a fantastically good cook, lots of dinner parties and fun and treats, and it was fantastic. But every time I came back from school, my mum would be playing the piano, Bach or Beethoven, and so for me, she was the most marvellous role model, comforter, encourager. She was one of five little girls in the vicarage at Aberdare, so great Welsh background, and she would be playing something like Fur Elise.
That was Alfred Brendel playing Beethoven's Bagatelle No. 25 in A minor, the Fur Elise. So this house then, Dame Julia Cleverdon, you said awash with books and fun and treats. You were born into it in 1950, and it was a family that was steeped in the BBC. Your father, Douglas Cleverdon, was a radio producer there, and your mother worked as a secretary. Just tell me, I've got something of the flavour of them. I have to say, I think they sound wonderful. Tell me more about them.
Very hospitable couple. My father brought everybody back for lunch and dinner.
Prior to your safe and successful delivery then, you mentioned earlier your mum she'd suffered seven miscarriages.
Yes.
Was there a sense in which then that you were, almost especially cherished because you'd been so longed for?
I suppose that must have been true. I mean, when I think about it now, it must have been absolutely heartrending. She spent 8 months in bed waiting to have me, and then 3 years later, my younger brother Lewis was born then they lost another baby, and then 10 years younger than me, the adored Francis was born.
And you, I mean, you chat away here, you know, you talk 10 to the dozen. Were you a chatty little girl?
Yes, I talked to such an extent that Lewis never found it necessary to say anything other than no until he was 5.
Is that true?
Yeah, I answered every question for him, and it was not helpful.
And you said your father worked round the corner and would bring people back after
all the
recordings.
Time.
Take me through a little guest list of who we might see coming through your front door.
Oh, well, very frequently near-suicidal poets, so Henry Reed and darling David Jones, the great Welsh war poet, John Betjeman and Stevie Smith.
Ted Hughes and Sylvia Plath, they were visitors.
On the day that poor Sylvia died, the children came to us because the great friends of ours lived round the corner and knew them very well, and we all went to the zoo. And my father was devoted to Ted, absolutely believed in him to the very end. And he had to support poets to write, actors to act, endlessly paying Lawrence of Arabia by motorbike and paying Dylan Thomas by numbers of lines and locking him in the BBC library and, you know, all of that sort of stuff.
What did you say, locking Dylan Thomas in the what?
Well, my father was trying to get Dylan Thomas to finish writing Under Milk Wood, and he decided the only thing to do was to lock him in the BBC library overnight, pay him by the line, and give him an enamel bucket for obvious use. And several nights running this worked. Papa, who'd always fought a tremendous battle with the bureaucrats, slightly like I always have, actually, was outraged to get a letter from somebody in the Beeb saying, by what right had he locked this man in the library? You know, he said, in the cause of art.
Very little changes, you'll be glad to hear. Right, tell me on that note then, tell me about this third disc. Pretty obvious why you've chosen it.
This is Richard Burton in my father's 1963 production of Under Milk Wood. And to my immense pleasure, Papa allowed me to play a very, very small bit part. So I sat in the studio listening to Richard Burton and that incredible Welsh cast.
What was your part?
I said, Captain Cat is crying. He's crying all over his nose.
Oh, that's very good.
To begin at the beginning. It is spring, moonless night in the small town, starless and Bible black. The cobble streets silent and the hunched quarters and rabbits wood limping invisible down to the slow black, crow black, fishing boat bobbing sea. The houses are blind as moles, though moles see fine tonight in the snouting velvet dingles, or blind as Captain Cat, there in the muffled middle by the pump and the town clock, the shops in mourning, the welfare hall in widow's weeds, and all the people of the lulled and dumbfound town are sleeping now.
Part of To Begin at the Beginning from the BBC radio recording of Under Milk Wood by Dylan Thomas, and we heard there, of course, Richard Burton as narrator. You started at the Camden School for Girls when you were 10, I think. The motto there, I think it might still be, is onwards and upwards. Clearly you took that to heart. What are your strongest memories from your time at school?
Well, I suppose the bus conductors used to shout at Camden, onwards and upwards, Camden girls, don't want you on the bottom deck. So, I mean, Camden was an absolutely inspirational school. Brilliant head teacher, Miss Birchall, the most fantastic, particularly in my later years, great history and English teachers. It was an inspirational place, and it absolutely drove into me both a belief that you've got to use your talents and do what you could to make the world a better place, but also the immense importance of teachers.
You went up to Cambridge, to Newnham College, to study history. It was the 60s. I find very often now when I ask castaways about university life during the 60s, they all seem to have been wearing buttoned-up cardigans and doing their studies. I hope you weren't. Did you have a bit of fun?
Yes, no. Cambridge was absolutely amazing for me. Julia Neuberger and I, she was the secretary of Newnham College, Cambridge, JCR, and I was the president, and we had the funniest time and fought all sorts of practical campaigns about, you know, could we have compulsory bicycle classes for freshers and Couldn't we have a laundrette in Newnham? I mean, I was always on the practical stuff. Some of the rest of them were, you know, passing resolutions for world peace. I was always slightly concerned as to what actually you could do within our own hands.
Let's have your next piece, then. We are on your fourth. Tell me about this.
This is Lara's theme from Dr. Zhivago. It takes me straight back to life at Camden with all my girlfriends. We all wore black velvet coats as the result of Lara, and we were passionate about the Russian Revolution as a result of Miss MacDonald and her teaching. So it's a hymn to teachers, really.
That was Lara's theme from the soundtrack to Dr. Zhivago, composed by Maurice Jarre and performed there by the City of Prague Philharmonic, conducted by Paul Bateman. So, Dame Julia Cleverdon, it was 1972 and there came a meeting that was, well, frankly, it was going to change your life. Tell me about the first time you met John Garnett. He was then director of the Industrial Society.
Oh, dear. I was sent by my tutor to see a man that she knew who she'd worked with in ICI, because she said if I didn't make up my mind by Friday as to which job I was going to take, I'd applied to the hospitals and the prisons, and I couldn't decide which to go for. And he said, my dear girl, very patronising, I don't know what you think you're doing, dealing with the blind, the sick, the halt, the lame and the criminal at the age of 22. You're not nearly old enough. And actually, the challenge is if we don't create the stuff in industry, you can't spend it anywhere else. You should be in industry. I then went to British Leyland, sent by him, sent to South Africa, Anglo-American mining, and then came on through the Industrial Society.
Let's just talk for a minute then about this young, wide-eyed, idealistic girl ending up on the shop floor of British Leyland in Swindon in the early 1970s. I mean, you were a junior industrial relations officer working predominantly with the night shift. I mean, talk about a breeding ground for the unreconstructed British male. Mm. How did they treat you? What did you come up against?
Well, they were... The shop floor were marvellous. They liked the fact that I was really interested as, you know, what were we doing on the quality stuff? Had anybody told anyone? Did the supervisors know more than the shop stewards? Never, actually. The shop stewards always knew more than the supervisors. I remember a dreadful factory director, after I made a point at a meeting, saying, ooh, any more bright ideas, girly? I learnt a hell of a lot about actually what happens, that most decisions taken at the top never happen at the bottom, that nothing is more important than team leaders. I learnt some absolutely basic things for the rest of my life.
And you went on, as you mentioned, to this secondment to South Africa. What were you doing there?
Oh, that was unbelievable. That was a real example of a highly impressive, responsible business, Anglo-American Mining, who decided that the only way for the future for South Africa was, in fact, to build a black trade union movement, and that in the end would get rid of apartheid, and they hoped in the short end. And I went as part of the Industrial Society's team to train young black team leaders to be shop stewards. One just understood both man's inhumanity to man and the absolutely crucial role that representatives could play in trying to change what happened.
You have had great, substantial, important successes, but with all your ideas and idealism, what do you think has been your biggest failure? What have you walked away from and thought, nope, that's it, I'm going to have to admit defeat there with that idea?
When I think that we started the Race for Opportunity campaign at Business and the Community in 1994, which really went back to my time in South Africa, to my understanding of the immense talent of diverse communities. Innovation comes from diversity, not from white male public school boys. And the Race campaign has taken much... It was, A, very difficult to start. I couldn't find any business leaders who really thought it was an issue in the mid-90s. The CBI wouldn't look at it, much better now. But actually, that's taken much longer to change than it should have done.
Let's have your next piece. We're on your fifth.
To some extent, saying that one of my pieces that I would have to have on this island is I Will Survive is because of the tough moments. whether there's getting it frightfully wrong on the first marriage where I shouldn't have married the man. I adored the family, fell for the family, still love the family. But actually, it was not right. Do not get married in the first 5 years after university. I spent my life in girls' schools prize giving saying, you change so much in the working world. You must try to pause a bit until you actually tie the knot. So I Will Survive would just help me at tough times when, I don't know, the mosquitoes were biting or whatever.
I Will Survive, Gloria Gaynor. How did you pick yourself up and dust yourself off after that short marriage and painful divorce?
Well, I suppose I threw myself into work, which is always my default mechanism, as my darling daughters say. I then fell for the boss, not by and large something to advise career women to do, but he and I just absolutely found a meeting of campaigning minds, caused a lot of misery to many people.
The boss, of course, being John Garners, who we mentioned earlier, the man who advised you to go into industry. You're a very pragmatic person. You're a very practical person. I would say you seem to me to be a realist, among all other things. When you fell for the boss, every other sort of reasoned part of your brain must have been screaming out to you, well, this seems a very silly thing to do, Julia.
But you see, I think love overcomes all. And I just, of course, it was a very inconvenient thing to do.
Because he was married with children.
He was married with children and had played an enormously important part in the development of the industrial society. Those were torrid times in the 80s. He was forever being called to do the inquiry into the miners' strike or whatever it was. And so it was not great for his career, and it certainly was quite a challenge as to what to do. But 82 Charity was born, 85 Victoria was born, and he was my absolute heart and soul.
After all the years of you know, the inconvenience and the turmoil and the secrecy and all the mess that it was, to have this open family life where things were resolved must have come as something of a relief. You must have felt bathed in a golden glow by that time.
Well, I don't think it was a golden glow for some others, but it was a very fulfilling and happy 20 years together.
Tell me about your next piece then. We're on your sixth.
I remember doing great performances in this lovely house he'd built in the Isle of Wight for us with the girls and cousins and lots of friends. And John, I remember, for Les Miserables, built the most amazing barricade of every broken-down bedstead across the whole of Wight was dragged into the garden. And in a way, Do You Hear the People Sing is all about how you actually listen to what's happening in society, whether on the front line in Burnley or Tottenham or Croydon, or whether on the front line in companies, what are they doing and how are they doing it? So Do You Hear the People Sing, for me, is a campaigning song.
Do you hear the people sing, singing the song of angry men? This is the music of a people who will not be slaves again. When the beating of your heart echoes the beating of the drums, there is a life about to start when tomorrow comes.
Do You Hear the People Sing from Les Miserables, performed there by the original London cast. Dame Julia Cleverdon, the president of business in the community is His Royal Highness the Prince of Wales. You're now in the role of vice president. You, as I understand it, you work very closely together. How do you get on?
Well, I think the Prince of Wales is, for me, one of the most inspirational leaders of society, has been a tremendous advocate for change, for engagement by the business world. He's a very practical campaigner.
And what about those people who say, and say loudly, that, you know, he should just keep his head down and get on with preparing to be king, rather than trying to influence policy, trying to potentially influence politicians? That's not his business. He should keep his nose out.
Generally, actually, he is very, very clear in my experience about what his role must be and about what corporates could do, charities could do, others could do. He's walked a difficult but careful line on all of that. The world would be a worse place if it wasn't for the Prince of Wales's engagement in these issues.
He strikes me as somebody who's got a pretty wry sense of humour. Do you have a good laugh together?
Oh, raw with laughter.
You had a run-in with Sir Philip Green, who's, of course, chairman of the Arcadia Group. What happened?
Business of the Community had always run a tremendous awards programme, and in that particular year, Marks & Spencers were the company of the year, and a jolly journalist rang me up when I was rather tired one night, and failing to engage brain before opening mouth, which is one of my problems, I said that I thought that the existing leadership of Marks & Spencers was outstanding, and I wasn't quite sure that a change would be a great idea.
And this was at a time when Sir Philip Green and the Arcadia Group was making a bid to take over Marks & Spencers.
Yes. And I'm sure I shouldn't have expressed myself in the way in which I did, so I apologised.
You mix with royalty, with politicians, with the very wealthy. I think you call them the chandelier lot, which is a great phrase. It's a long way from the shop floor at British Leyland. I wonder where you feel most at home.
I think for me, I always am most interested and most energised when I'm in the space between the connected world, who know everybody, who got address books to die for, who can convene business leaders and ministers and governments and all the rest of it, that world, and the front line, which is actually where most support and most concern is needed.
Let's go to your next track. It's your seventh. Tell me about this, Julia Cleverton.
Well, this is the most beautiful, peaceful, inspiring piece of work. I would listen to this forever, have it on whenever I'm in a state or too many speeches to write or things I haven't done. And it's Spanus Angelicus by Kiri de Canara.
Panis Angelicus, sung by Kiriti Kanawa. So, Dame Julia Cleverdon, as we know, you had a very happy, harmonious, dynamic marriage for 20 years, and then it ended very sadly and very suddenly when your husband John died in 1997. One can never, I would think, be prepared for the sudden death of a partner, of a spouse, but given that your husband was a good deal older than you, how many years older?
He was 30 years older than me.
Had you thought about it? Had you thought that the day will at some point inevitably come when here I will be with our daughters and he will no longer be there?
People often say to me, you must have thought of this, Julia. Actually, it was such a nirvana and so happy, I don't think I ever really had. And I thought if it did happen, I'd survive.
Well, of course you have. All of us handle grief uniquely, yeah. And there is no prescription for how we deal with it. But did you find that work absorbed you and was something of a solace and was a constant when you were working your way through the grief?
Yes, I did. I mean, I think house in the Isle of Wight, peaceful times. I remember going off after he died. I went for two walks by myself in Italy, stumbling about on, you know, vaguely gazing at a ridiculous little plan which said turn left at the ilex tree. I had no idea what an ilex tree was, but I just walked and wept for about a fortnight by myself. And that did help. But yes, work has always been for me the absolute solace and passion of life. So now I am looking at how to manage life. I've just taken on chairing the National Literacy Trust and a great new campaign called Read On, Get On. How do we get all young people to read? So there's always a campaign, but I think towards coming up to my 65th year, I do pace it better than I did.
I'm so glad that you brought that up, because I thought, how am I delicately going to approach the subject?
I'm not delicate at all.
So 65 isn't old by any stretch of the imagination these days, but it might be a time when many people would think, I'm going to move into a different gear. I'm going to change my life. There are things that I want to do that will not happen in the boardroom or the office or at the meeting table.
I do now see that I will always campaign. Till my dying breath, I will be trying to think what we could do to tackle something that we haven't managed to get right. But I think there is a bit more peace and fun and relaxation in life too.
Will a desert island be some sort of hell for you?
Yes.
No networking.
No networking.
Nothing, yes.
Nobody to talk to.
No.
No gossip. Yeah, my fingers would be itching to get on with the next thing.
Tell me about your final piece today then, Dame Julia Cleverdon. What are we going to hear?
Well, this, I suppose, takes me back to my Welsh roots. I'm a great believer in the importance of roots and understanding where one's come from. My faith is very important, and the influence of the Welsh history. My grandfather was a wheelwright, and my grandmother was Mam Gi, in charge of the woolen mill in Talabont. So Wales is important. So this would be Guide Me, O Thou Great Redeemer. My darling husband always said this was the great team briefing hymn, but actually Guide Me, O Thou Great Redeemer is a great solace and a strength and a shield for me.
Guide Me, O Thou Great Redeemer, sung by the Dunvant Male Choir with the Band of the Welsh Guards. So, Julia, it is nearly time to cast you away. I'm sorry about that. I'm going to give you the Bible and the complete works of Shakespeare. What else are you going to take to the island?
I think I'm going to take all the novels that Nancy Mitford ever wrote. There is a collected volume.
We shall give you that collected volume then. And a luxury. You're allowed something to make life a little more bearable.
If I could have a 2,000-piece jigsaw of Venice and the table to make it on. I love jigsaws. We always do them on holiday. It would take me back to family fights about who's lost the piece. And it would remind me of the most beautiful romantic place in the world.
Ah, it's yours then. And finally, which track would you save above all others?
Oh, Panis Angelicus.
Right, it's yours. Dame Julia Cleverdon, thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you. It's been such fun.
You've been listening to a download from the BBC. You'll find more information on the Radio 4 website, bbc.co.uk/radio4.